Karen.
I got a good meal last night. May it please the court, my name is Tom Berg and I represent Stephen Cook. We are the appellants in this search and seizure case. We bring to the court some interesting facts to chew on and really two significant issues.
This is a good one for a law school course on criminal procedure, isn't it?
It is. We've got curtilage, we've got third-party consent.
And an unusual residence.
And I have never, and I've been to this place, I've never seen a place that was so intentionally designed to exhibit an expectation of privacy. It's literally a barn converted into a fortress with no windows. And of course, the key problem is the front doors were two huge barn doors on rails, one of which had been blown down by Hurricane Ike. And it has been the government's assertion that because the door was down, that created a breezeway or an entryway into the interior of this particular structure, and therefore the curtilage moved from the first threshold to an interior threshold. That's the position that they've taken. The court has the photographic evidence of what the building looks like. Government Exhibit 1 was taken that very day, and then there are a whole series of defense exhibits, which are the pictures I took of the residence, obviously after the event. Within this so-called breezeway inside the door, the initial threshold of the two barn doors, was the personal property of Mr. Cook, was a hot tub, which I would think would be intimately connected with their personal life. And at the backside, although it was completely enclosed by a privacy fence, there was also a tarp which hung down. Some of the agents who testified during the course of the hearing claimed that there were wide open swinging doors on both ends, so that it looked almost like one of these drive-through liquor stores that you could go all the way through, but that was not what the photographs actually showed, and it was conflicting with what other agents testified was the actual appearance of it.
Drive-through liquor store, I'm not as familiar apparently as you are with drive-through liquor.
What they were trying to convey was that it was literally an open passage all the way through that you could see from the street, from the front to the back, okay. And it was big enough to move a vehicle through. That was not the circumstance at all. This was, I think, originally something of a barn structure, but it was built out on the inside, but the first threshold was the two barn doors. My client had posted the property no trespassing. It was set off about 50 feet from the street, enclosed by fences and by thick trees on three sides.
So is this like a reasonable person test, what a reasonable officer would think about which part is the residence and which part might be a business premises or whatever?
I think it's a question of whether it's a reasonable expectation of privacy exhibited by Mr. Cook that society is willing to recognize. He went to, as I said, extraordinary efforts.
But from the point of view of an officer who's never seen a place like this, so is it, I guess, is that part of the reasonable expectation and what an officer would think a person would expect about privacy in an unusual residence, an unusual building?
Well, except the officers were familiar with it. They'd had an informant on the inside. They were familiar with the general structure of it. They knew they had to get through two thresholds to get to the interior. And because they knew my client, they knew why he had basically said, "Don't come here." He even had a sign posted on the interior door which said, and there's a photograph of that as well as reference in the briefs, that if you've gotten this far, it's only because we let you in, which would tell any person coming up to this place that you're not welcome unless we gave you permission to be here. So I think he exhibited a classic situation of, this is my castle, don't come in. And the police utterly disregarded it. When they decided to do this knock and talk, they simply went through a door which had been breached as a result of a hurricane to get to the interior and basically ambush his 78-year-old mother inside the house by beating on the door until she finally came in. The reason they were there was not really to talk to her at all. They wanted to get a peek inside to see whether it looked like these photographs that they had. And they testified that that was the purpose that they went there. It was really, if they'd wanted to talk to her, they could have called her on a phone.
Can I ask three questions on this? How would a neighbor or a salesman announce their presence? In other words, is there any evidence in the photograph of the exhibit that there's a knocker or a bell on the outside broken door?
On the outside broken door, I think actually there was originally posted no trespassing.
No, not a sign. Is there a bell or a knocker?
There is not.
Okay.
There is not.
So
there
how
is
would, would a salesman have to, therefore, presumably go up the paved path on the inside to get to the very door that the police got to?
No, the salesman simply would not be admitted. They had a camera on a
How phone. Would a neighbor, a non-law enforcement officer, announce themselves to the grant to the grant to the mother?
They would have to knock on the exterior doors. They would be visible from the camera inside, and then the person inside would decide whether to admit them or not.
Because I agree, this isn't an open field. It's not a driveway. It's not, in that sense, that doctrine. On the other hand, it's not really intimately connected to the house because there's no way a trick-or-treater or a salesman or anyone could really draw attention to themselves.
Well, there are no salesmen or trick-or-treaters in that particular area. It's relatively rural. And that's why they chose it. They don't want their neighbors coming over. They've barricaded themselves, in a sense, so that that doesn't happen. They had a post office box. The mailman didn't come there to deliver mail. And that way they could control who came.
How do you – the last question I had was that our Thomas case in 1997, it looks very similar to these facts. How do you distinguish that decision? There we really pretty much said, open door, then you get to go in. Obviously, you didn't have the hurricane broken open door, but it's an open door, and we've applied that consistently. I counted at least 8 times. Whenever it's an open door without a bell or knocker at that opening, the police aren't at a disadvantage compared to other people who are trying to just announce themselves.
Except in this case, it's clear there are not other people trying to announce themselves. The property is posted, no trespassing, the building is offset. But for a hurricane, the police would have to knock. And in previous encounters with the police, that's exactly what had happened. They had to come knock on the door.
I should have let you answer that final question I had. How do you distinguish the Thomas decision?
The distinction here is that the only reason the door is, quote, open is because it's been knocked down by a hurricane.
Okay. So if they'd left it open...
Had they left it open, had they been careless, that's one thing. But
if it's a hurricane caused...
But here they never failed to exhibit their insistence that this is private and you don't go past here. But for the hurricane, that door would have been up and there would have been no way for them to gain access unless someone let them in. So that's, I guess that's the critical distinction, is does the Fourth Amendment move with the wind? Is it the fortuity of the storm, which suddenly moves the threshold of the house to the interior? And we're not talking about trick-or-treaters or Girl Scouts selling cookies. We're talking about the police coming in with no exigency. And we know that the reason the police are there is not to even talk. It's to get inside and look. They want to conduct a search. Which leads us to the second issue, which is...
Ms. Burke, before you leave that, we know that... These officers had a right with virtually no cause to knock and talk. In fact, that's basic police tactic now. If they don't have probable cause or warrant yet, they can knock and talk. Where on this property would an officer knock and talk?
Had they knocked and talked? Well, I asked them, could you have called if you wanted to have her come outside and visit with you? Yes, but we didn't want to do that, was the response.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow it.
I asked the officers why they didn't call her if all they wanted to do was talk to her and have her come outside. They said, no, we didn't want to do that. That was not our plan. The plan was always to gain entry. So it was really not, it was a knock and enter plan that they came with. They call it knock and talk because they start with the knock on the door and then they ultimately gain entry so that they can look inside. But that really wasn't a knock and talk that they intended. This was not intended to be a conversation. It was intended to be a visual search to confirm information so they could go get a warrant.
Well, we surely wouldn't require an officer to telephone and say back, I'm coming to see you, would you? I mean, that would be a rather severe compromise of knock and talk, wouldn't it?
Well, we're looking at what the officers are trying to do is get third party consent.
Doors, I mean.
They've already been told no by Mr. Cook. So what they're looking for is a way to get third-party consent to get in there. They're pretty sure that Mr. Cook's wife isn't going to let him in, so they go after the 78-year-old mother, who they know is there, because they've been monitoring the phone calls. They even know that she's been told not to let anybody in, but they're willing to go in raid gear for this knock and talk and see what they can get done.
Was there some point on the property where they should have stopped in order to conduct a knock and talk?
At the first threshold where one door was still up and the other one was partially down.
And if they knocked there, what would be the result?
What would be the result? Well, there's a pole-mounted video camera, and they learn, of course, that she's watching them from inside anyway. They knock, and she probably doesn't let them in.
Are you saying that they stopped at the first point at which they were being able to knock and conduct and talk?
I think that they have to. If the curtilage has any meaning, if that first threshold is the beginning of the house, that's where they have to stop. They could no more, if you're in your kitchen, open your front door and come into your living room because you're in the kitchen in order to initiate a knock and talk.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that door was blown down by the storm or it was up, that was where they have to stop to conduct the knock and talk. They don't get to make entry first. And that's what I contend happened. Once they cross that threshold, they've made an entry in violation of the curtilage and in violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Where was that threshold?
The threshold was right where the doors would normally be standing. And one was still standing and the other one had fallen down. That was literally a threshold. As the officer testified, he had to cross two thresholds to gain entry. The first threshold was the barn doors, and the second threshold was the two doors on the interior.
Okay.
Which leads to our second problem for the law students. They asked Mr. Cook while he was in jail, can we search your house? And he said no. And that's when they decided, and they just lost a case against Mr. Cook. He'd been acquitted by a jury up in Polk County. He tells them no, but he's in jail. So how many times can they then go to the well to get third-party consent to get in there? Is his refusal to give consent of no import under the Fourth Amendment? If you give a narrow reading to...
There's a circuit split on that, right?
There is a circuit split. The Ninth Circuit has read... Georgia v. Randolph broadly and said that once that invocation is made, that has to be respected. The Seventh Circuit has gone probably just as far the other way and said if the person is not physically present, because those happen to be the facts in Georgia versus Randolph, if the person is not present, then it doesn't apply.
Long way from Pasadena to Chicago. I said it's a long way between Pasadena and... in Chicago.
It is. It's a long way.
Does it help or hurt your case that the record here that you elicited from the mother shows that she actually got a call from her son saying, don't let him in, and she chose to let them in? That actually, therefore, it looks like a co-tenant saying, I'm going to let them in spite of his desire against it. Right?
Well,
that was the testimony you elicited.
I mean, if she'd obviously said, at the time, they're not coming in either, and they'd never let them in, we wouldn't be here. Those are the facts that bring this kind of case to the court because the district court did find, although I disagreed with it below, that she had consented to their entry,
right,
assuming that they had not violated the curtilage. So obviously it does not help our circumstance. That's why we're here, is that we are stuck with the district court's finding that she did consent, even though she had been told, don't let them in. But it's not like she went to them and said, please come in, which is often the scenario where the first person says no, and then the second person, let's say the disgruntled wife in some of these cases, says, no, I want you to come in. This is a place where they went and like I said, basically ambushed her within the house itself, dressed in SWAT gear, entering into the interior, and got the so-called consent. So it's different in that regard. The question is Mr. Cook's refusal of any moment under the Fourth Amendment, or can they simply keep going to the well till they get someone to say okay?
Right, your initial time has expired, Mr. Bergen. You've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Babcock?
May it please the court, counsel, good morning. My name is Jeff Babcock, and I represent the United States. I have two housekeeping matters that I need to correct. First, I transposed the Georgia versus Randolph citation, the style of the case, repeatedly. Same mistake that the district court made. It should be Georgia versus Randolph as opposed to Randolph versus Georgia. And then second, and this is very important, I made three representations on page 20, 22, and 23 that what the district court found with regard to consent was that Ima Cook consented to search or to a search of the residence, and that's not true. What she consented to was a consent to the entry into the house. And so there's a huge difference between a consent to search and a consent to chat or a consent to bring somebody in, and that's what really differentiates the case. With regard to, and I'll go ahead and just go straight to this consent issue, is that the Secret Service, first it was a Texas Ranger, then it was a Secret Service that went to Cook and said, can we get consent to search your house for devices that would that could manufacture counterfeit money? And Cook said no. He refused the consent. And he communicated with his mother the day before, and that's in Government's Exhibit Number 21, you know, do not let anybody in. And so one of the concerns that some of the case law has talked about is whether or not the other co-tenant would be aware of the refusal to consent. And remember, this is a consent to search as opposed to a consent to chat. The officers went, and as Judge Higginson has pointed out, the Thomas case is perfect comparison, because the Thomas case involved an open gate outside of an apartment complex. This was an open door to this.
The Thomas is on the curtilage question.
That's yeah. So that's
is
that's
that the one you're addressing? You're not
yes.
talking about the Randolph.
No. That's correct, Your Honor. But anyway, but when the officers went to talk to Ms. Cook, not only was she aware of what her son had told her over the phone, but that they had the monitoring system, and she could see that there was a marked patrol unit that had come, and all these people were in their raid jackets. And so when they were knocking on that door, which was the natural place to go in order to go directly to the door and contact whoever's in there, Ms. Cook said, who's there, who's there? And the officer said, and this was ATF Rosanna Tenet UK, I just want to talk to you. And she opened the door.
Right.
This was not a search.
Just on the Dunn factors, if you're talking about the curtilage, if the district court had ruled here against you, you'd never be able to reverse it on appeal, right? Because three of the four factors favor Cook.
Well, I don't know whether we'd get permission to appeal.
Right. You might
that
not
would
get,
be that but, was that's but, probably a bigger okay, issue.
But this, you know, this is not a driveway, it's not an open field. It's a remarkably the proximity and the fortress-like characters. Let me ask it another way. If the door hadn't been open,
Then we...
You lose.
The judge said that we would lose.
And was there a bell or a knocker?
No.
Judge Higginbotham's question, sir, is could any normal non-law enforcement person have announced themselves any way other than walking up to the door?
No.
Okay.
There was no other way. On page of the record 710, walking through that open pathway through the carport, was that the only way to get to the front door to knock on the front door? And the answer was yes. And so that's the key as it is for that area. And the thing is that picture, GX1, that was taken was not taken at 3 o'clock when the officers first got to the scene, and it wasn't taken exactly at 8 o'clock when they were executing the warrant that had been acquired at 7:30. The officer said, I took that picture knowing that we were working to get a search warrant, and I took it at dusk. And the back of this compound, this barn-like area, there was testimony that there were doors. And there was also testimony that there was a drop-down sheet that was lifted up, and that the doors were actually wider open than what was depicted in government's exhibit number 1. So you could see through and through. And that's what caused the officers that when they were going there, is that, okay, well, we know from what an informant had said that there's these doors over here on the left. And they went directly there. They didn't go into anything else. They didn't search anything. All they were doing was knocking on the door. They stayed there for maybe between 5 and 10 minutes, giving about a minute or two for the knocking and a minute for Ms. Cook to say, who's there, who's there? Okay, she opens the door, the officers walk in, and they can immediately see in plain view the safe. And Agent Benning says, hey, is that a gun safe? Yes, that's a gun safe. Well, are there guns in there? Yes, there's guns in there. Those are my son's guns. So the Randolph case dealt with a consent to search where you have that previous refusal. And here we're just talking about chatting, whether you can have a consensual encounter. And the answer is yes, because if the
trouble
woman...
is, right, Randolph pretty much 5-4 decision. And most of what the court said in Randolph is, if you have a present co-tenant, physically present objecting, then you can't go in, right?
Right.
Well, here
you can't. The consent would not be effective,
right. Okay.
by the other present co-tenant.
Right. But here, when you happen to know the co-tenant makes a phone call saying, I am presently objecting, and Secret Service knows that, they tell ATF that's in the task force entry going there, isn't it the functional equivalent of Cook, the son, being present and objecting?
Well, as to a search,
okay,
but
so
not
that,
as
but,
to the communication.
Okay, but that wasn't a distinction you drew in your brief at all. That's completely new now, the search entry distinction.
Well, the...
What's the best case on that? I've never seen that.
Well, first of all, if you take Judge Breyer's concurrence... in his opinion, he points out that Randolph is limited to its facts, and he says that the person has to be present, not that there's a present objection, but that they have
right.
to physically be present. So, you know, right there would be the differentiation.
Let's say Cook, the son, was about to get out of jail, and you kept him in longer to be able to have time to go to the mother. You lose then?
No.
So... you could restrain him?
Because what we're talking about is a consensual encounter. In other words, what the court is suggesting is that a non-present objecting person, who is in essence a third party, can bar or invalidate any consensual encounter with another person.
Well,
because they objected.
Well,
not to the I object to you
I don't want
to talking
push the
to
point,
a law enforcement.
That's how I read Randolph. If you're present and you object, you can veto the co-tenant's approval.
Consent to search.
Okay, but that's the distinction you're just coming up with now.
No, Your Honor, it's not, because the judge's order said The question was is whether there was consent to the entry.
Okay.
Okay? And it was my fault in my brief where I say, well, it was consent to search. Yeah. That's not what the agents were found to have done or what they testified to.
So if they had searched, the consent wouldn't have been valid? Is that what you're saying?
Be a different fact. I think we're going to have to deal with that, you know, in a proper case. This isn't the case. You don't have that here. What we have, so Randolph doesn't even apply. I would submit, let's take the Murphy case, for instance. The concern with Murphy is that there was government action that did something to remove the objecting person. And Judge Reinhart, you know, had a problem with that, and the California court had a problem with that. Whereas in Hudspeth and in Henderson, the court says, look, if the person is not
your
there.
Let me just be clear. Your position now is that all of the case law discussed in the briefs is inapplicable. Randolph doesn't even apply because no search was effectuated.
No, I'm saying that there was no Fourth Amendment violation, and the judge properly denied the suppression motion.
Okay.
And I distinguish Randolph by saying the defendant was not present. And so that's true. And then the other problem is what actually the court found was that this was a consent to go into the house, a consent to entry. And I think the court would agree, if you have that fact, any basis on which to support the judge's ruling could be relied upon by the court. And so the evidence is that the officers went directly to the door. They were trying to have a consensual encounter. They had a consensual encounter, and on that basis, as well as what is found by the court, and the court found that was a consensual encounter, that differentiates the case from a situation where you have third-party consent. So I submit that. And the government did cite the Thomas case for that other issue, and I'd also point out that there are the arguments are laid out not only in the judge's order, but in the government's original response to the motion to suppress, that in the amended response to the motion to suppress, the government incorporated its previous answer because there was a second issue about the Polk County activity.
Both these issues are very fact specific, right?
Yes, sir.
Why agree to a conditional plea? Why not, you know, on a 1922G count, go to trial and get the facts cleared up?
Well, I can't answer that, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
No, sir.
No,
you weren't?
No, sir.
But was there a factual basis submitted in connection with the plea?
There was.
And did it go to any of these facts?
It did not alter any of the legal issues that they preserved for the purposes of the appeal.
Okay, Mr. Babcock, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Berg, you've saved time for rebuttal.
Briefly, the government wants us to, I guess, consider this case in the vacuum as if Mr. Cook's refusal to give consent never occurred, and they simply went out there to conduct a chat. The testimony of the agents on cross-examination was they went in there to get a chance to look inside. It was a search. That was their purpose. That's the reason they didn't call or even want to meet outside the structures. They wanted to look in. They wanted to see if that looked like the pictures that they had. And that was never in dispute. That was the government agent's testimony, is they wanted to look inside. They could care less about talking to Ms. Cook about what happened to her house in Rye, Texas, and the troubles with getting help on getting the house fixed. That was not the reason they went to talk to her. They went there to get in to look.
But you would have no legitimate expectation of privacy to the extent that views are are made possible by the knock and talk. You know, implicit in the validity of knock and talk is a want of privacy to what would normally be viewed and seen by conducting a knock and talk, right? You can't.
It depends on where the knock and talk happens.
Well, if you knock and talk at the front door, and if they invite step inside, that's still a knock and talk.
Well, the difference is you and I disagree probably on where the front door is. But that, for me, the front door was the barn doors, and they're already way past them.
Well, I'm not right. Focusing on the curtilage issue at the moment. I'm talking on the knock and talk.
Yeah, I understand that there are any number of motives and pretexts involved in a knock and talk, and we sort of nod and wink at it because we know they're not there to chat. That's not, they're there to ferret out evidence to go arrest somebody, and that's what they wanted to do here. If there are any additional questions.
No, thank you, Mr. Berg, and your case is under submission. We noticed that you're court appointed. We appreciate your willingness to take the appointment and your good work on behalf of your client.
I thank y'all.